Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. I am Bob Enyart, the pastor of Denver Bible Church. This is Theology Thursday. Typically, we look at the news of the day from a Christian worldview. Today, we look at the source of the Christian worldview, God's Word. Is there evidence for the resurrection of Jesus Christ? Millions celebrate Christ's resurrection from the dead. If we were to read even secular accounts of history, the history of the first century, 2,000 years ago, such as that from the Encyclopedia Britannica, we would read of the terrible death which Jesus suffered at the hand of Pontius Pilate. Jesus was crucified, and for the moment, that pacified, it quieted the religious leaders in Judea who wanted him stopped. He was embarrassing them. Jesus threatened their reputations because he opposed them. They could not control the influence he had. So they used their influence on the Roman governor, Pilate, and succeeded in having Jesus killed. Over the next few decades, there was a dramatic growth throughout the Roman world of the sect of believers who said that Jesus Christ, after he was crucified, rose from the dead. Did Jesus rise from the dead? Does it matter whether he did or not? Some who attend church, and a number of those who pastor churches, believe that it doesn't matter whether Jesus rose from the dead or not. These are often called liberal churches. They say that doesn't matter. In fact, some say it's positively wrong to assert that Christ did rise from the dead, and you shouldn't hope that he did because it's foolishness. Well, I realize when you preach a sermon, you should preach your own sermon. But I would like to bring to you a sermon from another Denver area minister from last year. Easter Sunday morning last year, my sons Josiah and Nathaniel attended a United Methodist Church, and I want to relate to you the crux of the minister's message from that church. I was not there in attendance, and I only have the recollection of my boys to go on. But as I recall, they both told the same story, and they began telling it soon thereafter, after they heard the message, and they've told it occasionally and even recently. The pastor said that the resurrection story embarrassed him. He wished that if he were able, he wished he could take it out of the Bible. That was his sermon, along with, I imagine, some heartwarming stories about family and friendship and determination and renewal. That was probably part of it. But the crux of it was Jesus Christ did not rise from the dead. That was the message. Probably this morning, right now, as we are here, a year later, there are people sitting in pews in that same church, and they're getting more of the same, along with perhaps some artwork of rabbits and eggs on their bulletins. Paul would not agree with a minister who says that Christ's resurrection is unnecessary to our faith, our life, our hope. If Christ is not risen, then our preaching is lies, for the book that we read from is unreliable, and worse, it's the product of lies. Liars then wrote the Bible. On the other hand, the majesty of the Bible, the sensibility of it, the uncanny nature of its ancient prophecies, its observations can all be explained by the resurrection. Because if the resurrection is true, then the book is true. For if Jesus rose from the dead, then that fact harmonizes all the other facts of his life. And if he rose from the dead, then we could accept the supernatural origin of the scriptures. Now, contrary to some, but according to Paul, If Christ has not risen, not only is our preaching empty, but our faith is also empty because it's blind and it's wrong. And we are found to be false witnesses of God because we have testified of God that he raised up Christ, whom he then would not have raised up. Now, the Methodist pastor might argue, I haven't been a false witness because I've never said that Jesus was raised up. I've said it's not true. He was not raised. Well, then that minister would be a false witness in an even greater way, because he perpetuates the religion that he claims is a fraud, founded by liars. He reads from a book and thereby endorses it, which he claims was written by men determined to deceive. If the New Testament was written by cheats and scams, then it's unreliable. And the men who know that and promote it anyway and tolerate it, they are, of all Christians, the most deceptive and the most deceived. Christianity speaks of salvation from sin and death, of regeneration and rebirth to eternal life. But as Paul said, if Christ is not risen, your faith is futile. You are dead in your sin. So did Jesus rise from the dead, or did he not? Jesus Christ was born at the time of the census that was ordered by Caesar Augustus. And he died during the reign of Tiberius Caesar. The Bible says that Christ was crucified under the authority of the Roman governor, Pontius Pilate. Webster's dictionary, under the entry for Pilate, says, first century AD, Roman procurator of Judea, who condemned Jesus to be crucified. And he governed there for about 10 years, from 26 to 36 AD. Now, I will quote some excerpts from an article in Encyclopedia Britannica. This is their 1976 edition that I have at home, on their article entitled Crucifixion. If you're doing a report for school on the death penalty, and you do it on crucifixion, and you go to the Encyclopedia Britannica, here is what you would read. Crucifixion. In the ancient world, the method of capital punishment, particularly among the Persians, Jews, and Romans, there were various methods of performing crucifixion. Usually the condemned man, after being whipped, dragged the crossbeam of his cross to the place of punishment where the upright shaft was already fixed. There he was stripped of his clothing and bound fast with outstretched arms to the crossbeam, or nailed firmly to it through the wrist. The crossbeam was then raised up against the upright shaft and made fast to it about 10 feet above the ground. Next, the feet were tightly bound or nailed to the upright shaft. The Bible records that Jesus Christ was put to death in this terrible way. And to continue with this article, in Encyclopedia Britannica, it reads, over the criminal's head was placed a notice stating his name and crime: Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews. Death, the article continues, apparently by exhaustion or by heart failure, could be hastened by breaking the legs with an iron club. Now, crucifixion was used to punish political agitators, religious rebels. That same article in Britannica states that Darius, king of Persia, on one day crucified 3,000 political opponents in 519 BC, 500 years before Christ. The last two lines of that paragraph that tells us about that history say this: in about AD 32, Pontius Pilate crucified Jesus of Nazareth. Jesus being crucified is a central event in the history of the world, which has affected the lives of hundreds of millions of believers and even the whole world of unbelievers. Christ's life and death has had a profound effect upon history, politics, science, culture and upon you, upon each one of us, Jesus Christ, his life and death has affected our relationships, the country we live in, and the things we believe. Jesus never wrote a book. He never traveled far from home. He never raised an army or acquired great wealth. He never held office. Neither was he an inventor nor an entertainer. He claimed to be Lord. He called grown men children. Their records tell us that he said that he would be crucified and then would rise from the dead. And their lives seem to back up that claim because almost all of them went to their deaths affirming the fulfillment of that prediction. Did the apostles lie about the resurrection? Well, what makes men lie? Men will lie to advance their power or increase their wealth. They will lie to confound their enemies. They will lie for many reasons. Lying, sadly, is a common human behavior. Did the apostles lie about the resurrection? Well, it's not common, not by any stretch, to find men dying to protect their own lies. See, men will lie to get ahead, but if the lie is going to hurt them, like their own flesh and their body, and they're going to be executed, typically men will recant a lie. The apostles died telling the world of Christ's resurrection. Throughout history, men have often died for lies, but it's lies that they did not know were lies. They were told by their leader that they were establishing a great new realm of justice, but it was cruelty, and it was a lie, and they were deceived. But when men make up a lie, then they know it's a lie. And will they die to protect that lie? Let's think through that. You know, men do not die defending a lie they know to be false. They don't do that. If a murderer, for example, might claim to be innocent, "I didn't do it," right up to the moment he's led to the electric chair, "I did not do it." But even at that moment, if he finds out that he could be freed, if only he admits the truth, he'd suddenly remember what really happened that night many years ago. Because people lie to advance themselves, but not to get themselves killed. That's very strange and unlikely human behavior. The apostles died because they said that Jesus Christ rose from the dead. And think of the way that they died. The brutal methods of execution from 2,000 years ago. Stephen was stoned to death, affirming the resurrection of Jesus Christ. The apostle John lived out his life in exile on Patmos, but all the others were killed. Generations of Christians have related Peter, not considering himself worthy to die as Christ died, was crucified upside down. In 2,000 years, the best minds of the unbelieving world, of those who reject Christianity, the smartest among them, have tried to solve the riddle of Christianity. And they've tried to say that Jesus did not rise from the dead. Well, if that's true, then they must explain the behavior of the early Christians and of the circumstances surrounding his life and death, and then the birth of the Christian church. So how could the men with great IQ have addressed that problem? They've said, we want to somehow show what really happened back then, because obviously Jesus did not rise from the dead. So they've really tried hard, but they've pretty much had a difficult time coming up with an alternative explanation of the facts. And they've come up with four theories. The theories, some of them are almost embarrassing to repeat, but this is the best the unbelieving world has done. They've had the wrong tomb theory, that the women in early Sunday morning went to the wrong tomb, and so they started a rumor that Jesus had risen from the dead. A hallucination theory, that all the many people who claimed to see Jesus after he rose from the dead had hallucinated. The swoon theory, that Jesus didn't actually die, but he fainted. went into a coma perhaps, and then in the cool of the tomb revived. And finally, the theft theory that Christ's body was stolen. And so that's where it got started, this rumor that he rose from the dead. These attempts to explain the evidence around Christ's death are the best that I've seen that skeptics have come up with in 2,000 years. So I want to talk through those four theories. The wrong tomb theory suggests that in the darkness of that early Sunday morning, the women went to the wrong tomb. Never mind that it was the tomb of a wealthy man, Joseph of Arimathea, that it was the only tomb in the garden, that the garden was adjacent to the place where Jesus was crucified, only a moment's walk from Golgotha and from the city wall. Never mind that those same women had helped to bury Jesus a few days earlier. Never mind that guards were stationed at the tomb. Never mind that the apostles also then would have had to go to the wrong tomb. And that the Jewish and Roman officials who would have liked to stop this sect from growing, that they must have misplaced the tomb also, because they could have gone and got the body of this guy who they said he rose from the dead. And they said, no, he didn't. Here he is. He's dead. The wrong tomb theory fails to explain away the events of 2,000 years ago. How about the hallucination theory? Perhaps that can carry greater weight. Maybe all those who said they saw Jesus rise from the dead, maybe they think they saw him. Because, you know, they were his followers, believers. They were so distraught that he was crucified. What were they going to do with their lives? And there was a mass hallucination. I'd like to quote one of the men who promote this view. He graduated from Princeton. He's a New Testament scholar named John Machen. He wrote, "The Christian church is founded upon a pathology. If there had been a good neurologist for Peter and the others to consult, there never would have been a Christian church." See, it was a neurological problem. Neurology deals with the nervous system and disorders affecting it. If they all hallucinated, then Christianity, the Christianity that our United Methodist minister is promoting, is a belief system launched by lunatics who could not discern fantasy from reality. Were the appearances by Christ to the apostles and to more than 500 who claimed to see him after he rose from the dead, were those appearances, were they visions, flights of fantasy, hallucination? Men who are subject to hallucination do not become moral heroes. The effect of Christ's resurrection transformed lives, brought strength to the weak and courage to the fearful. You can devise a profile of the kind of person who experiences a hallucination and the state of mind that that person is in. But think of the kinds of people and the states of mind of those who said they saw Christ after he rose from the dead. Mary Magdalene was weeping. The women generally were afraid and astonished. Peter, he was full of remorse. Thomas was doubting. The two on the Emmaus Road, they were completely unsuspecting. The disciples in Galilee had returned to their fishing boats. And Saul of Tarsus, who was a law enforcement officer, was on his way to arrest some of the lunatics. Those were the circumstances and the state of mind under which so many said they saw Jesus Christ risen from the dead. The swoon theory suggests that Jesus, having been crucified, passed out and taken for dead, he was buried, but then recovered in the cool of the tomb. Now, he had been beaten. When he was mocked, he was beaten, scourged, 39 lashes, which would almost kill a man, a crown of thorns pressed into his head, and then he was crucified. And Roman soldiers who were experienced executioners wanted to make sure these three were dead because a holiday was coming up and everybody wanted to get off of work. And so they went to the first guy and they broke his legs, because when you're being crucified, you prop yourself up to breathe. Otherwise, you can suffocate. And when they break their legs, they died quicker. And the other murderer, criminal, broke his legs. They came to Jesus. They said, he's already dead. We don't have to break his legs. And so they took a sword just to make sure and pierced it in the side. And the way we have the description of water and blood poured out, showing that Christ had already been dead, fluids in his body began to separate, his cardiovascular sac had been broken, he was dead. They say, well, he didn't die, he just passed out. But such a broken Jesus could never have escaped from the guard outside the tomb. Neither could he have appeared as the resurrected Lord of glory to muster the troops. He would have been in an intensive care unit. Neither could he have traveled all over Israel in the next few days. Neither could he have avoided the authorities who would have loved to finish the job. And then he would have had to live out the rest of his life somehow, whether it was a few weeks or months or years, and then die. And somehow he'd live somewhere, and somehow we'd have known about it through rumors at least. You know, people are not very good at keeping secrets. Individuals have a hard time keeping secrets. Groups, less well so. Unstable groups of liars and lunatics would not be well qualified to keep secrets. What two people do in secret is often shouted from the rooftops and sometimes around the world. So these arguments, they work to refute these theories and the final theory, the theft theory, that the apostles stole Jesus' body. The soldiers posted at the tomb, they were posted there because the rumor spread that Jesus claimed he would rise from the dead. So the high priest didn't like that. He went to Pilate and he said, this guy said he was going to rise from the dead. We don't want this to spread. And Pilate agreed to put a guard at the tomb. And on the third day in the morning, Jesus was risen and he was gone. And the guard then would be in quite a bit of trouble. What in the world happened on your watch? So the high priest said to them, don't worry, we'll pay you to tell this lie. Tell Pilate that while you slept, the disciples came and stole his body. And you know, that explanation has been believed to this day by millions of people. Millions have believed that. The guards went to Pilate and said, we fell asleep, and while we slept, the disciples stole his body. Now, that story is self-refuting. If they slept, they could not possibly know what happened. If they slept. But yet millions have taken a tremendous amount of evidence and thrown it to the wind to believe what is obviously a lie, or obviously not known, or just a fabricated excuse. So did they steal the body? Did they steal Jesus' body? Certainly that's plausible. That's possible. This cult started this story because they stole the body. Well, does that fit with the circumstances? As of that weekend that Christ died, Peter, we knew, was a coward, denied Christ three times, even in front of a servant girl. He's going to go sneak past guards, Roman guards, to steal a body. Thomas was a doubter. They were of a mind to return to their former life as fishermen. Generally, we find in the Bible a brutally honest account of the men who wrote it. Contrast the Bible with other religious books and the men who wrote them, like, for example, Muhammad, who gives only a glowing account of his life with no sin, no wickedness, just great honor and glory for Muhammad. He wrote the book. Compare the Bible to that. The Old Testament, the history of Israel, is an epic tale of the utter failure of the Jewish nation. Now, every nation in the world has utterly failed. But which nation was as honest as Israel? To write a book would become the world's bestseller, and to detail the wickedness, not only of themselves as a nation, but of almost all of their great leaders and patriarchs. Read the book that the Jews have given us, and we're so thankful they have, the Bible. You read this book and you find out that Adam rejected God. Noah failed as a father. Abraham offered his wife to another man to save his own skin. Jacob was a thief. Of his sons, 11 of them sold their brother into slavery. The judges that ruled over the nation for centuries ruled over utter rebellion and wickedness toward man and God. Israel's first king, Saul, was a fool who hated God. Their second king, David, was an adulterer and a murderer who destroyed his own family and his nation, but repented in tears. So he's in heaven. Their third king, Solomon, lived a vile and wicked life, worshiping the false gods of his 1,000 wives and concubines, and so on through the history of Israel. If the history they recorded was not the truth, then why not make yourself look better? Thieves, liars, hallucinators are not known for being brutally honest about their failures, are they? Think, because either Jesus Christ, either his story was put together as a fraudulent effort, or men of integrity spoke the truth, or they were deceived. And so when we look at their behavior and the legacy they left us of the founding of the Christian church and the Bible completed, we can get some kind of an idea of what they were like and the sacrifices they made. And how many were in on this? If it was a lie, how many were in on the theft, the fraud, the lies, and not a one ever recanted? Not a one. You know, you've got gang members who are involved in a shootout, and the police get them, and they separate them, and within about 9 minutes, they're all telling on each other. That's the way it works when you're not standing on principle, truth, and justice and integrity. So you see, people who want to reject the gospel of Jesus Christ, they have some work to do. They have to figure out how the central event of human history came to pass and what other explanation accounts for the many details. Not one ever recanted? Not one ever came clean? How many people claim they saw Christ after he had risen? Well, many people claim that they saw Jesus, and among them were many who knew him prior to his crucifixion for some time, including his family members, like his mom and his brothers and sisters and his friends and followers. Paul wrote in that same chapter I was quoting, 1 Corinthians 15, in verse 3, he wrote this, that Christ died for our sins according to the Scriptures, and that he was buried, and that he rose again the third day, and that he was seen by Peter, by the 12 apostles. After that, he was seen by over 500 brethren at once, of whom the greater part remain to the present, but some have fallen asleep. Now, that's a euphemism, a figure of speech for some died. Right? But Paul said, we can name the list of the people who claimed to see Jesus, see that he had risen from the dead. And this is the chapter in which he says, now, if Christ did not rise, we're fools and we're wrong. But these are the people who claimed to have seen him after he rose. Peter was very well known in Jerusalem, especially by the time Paul was converted and started writing. The 12 apostles generally, not just Peter. He'd appeared to a group as large as over 500 people. And then he said, of whom the greater part remain to the present, but some have died. So when Paul wrote the letter to the Corinthians sometime in the 50s, not the 1950s, but the 50s, 2,000 years ago, about two decades after Christ's death, he said at that time that most of the eyewitnesses to Christ's resurrection were still alive. And of course, that means that they could be inquired of, interviewed, cross-examined, and put to death, which happened to many of them. And then Paul says that Jesus appeared to him also. And it was for his faith in the resurrection that he was long imprisoned and eventually beheaded. Apart from the contemporaneous accounts of Christ's resurrection, there exists a body of evidence from history that corroborates that event. It is additional evidence that Christ rose from the dead. Other evidence, apart from what the apostles said and the followers of Christ, the Old Testament was complete centuries before Jesus was born. It was written in Hebrew because the Jews, their language is Hebrew. And some of our friends study Hebrew so we could do a better job of understanding their writings. Well, the Hebrew Old Testament was translated into Greek about 200 years before Jesus was born. We know that from many sources, secular sources, non-Christian sources, like H.G. Wells in his massive The Outline of History, dates when the Septuagint was written, the Greek translation of the Old Testament. The Encyclopedia Britannica, a first century historian like Josephus, or a first century philosopher like Philo. These sources, these authorities, these contemporaneous witnesses and historians tell us that the Greek translation of the Old Testament was done long before Jesus was ever born. Does that matter? Is that a big deal? Well, there are so many prophecies of Jesus in the Old Testament, and they're so uncanny, and they're so difficult to explain away that people have said, well, those prophecies were written after the fact. After Jesus was born and lived and died, that's when a lot of those prophecies were penned in. Why would they say that? Well, because if they were written hundreds of years prior, that is overwhelming evidence that God exists, He wrote a book, and it speaks of Jesus Christ, who will judge us after we die. And many people don't want to buy that whole story. They rather live their lives as they want to live it, discounting God, so they could ignore God. God is not a factor in my thinking. I will do what I want to do. So they take the prophecies that led up to Jesus and they try to do away with them. They say, well, they were written after the fact. But it's not true. They were written hundreds of years before. So the messianic prophecies in the Old Testament could not have been written after to correspond with Christ's life and death. They had to be written in advance. And so many of those details of the prophecies were far beyond the control of this radical religious teacher, Jesus. He could not have controlled the place of his own birth, as Micah had prophesied that he would be born in Bethlehem. And Jesus could not have moved Caesar Augustus to take a census of the whole Roman world, to call for that census so that Joseph, Christ's stepdad, who was a descendant of David, would have to travel to Bethlehem to be registered in the census. And when they were in Bethlehem, just when they got there, Mary gave birth and Jesus was born, and the census was to see who's alive, what's your name, and where were you born. So here's Joseph under international law by the Roman emperor in Bethlehem, the place prophesied by Micah hundreds of years earlier where the Messiah would be born. And what does he record in the history and the official documents of the world? Jesus Christ was born this day in Bethlehem of Judea. That was one prophecy. There are many, many prophecies. That he would be born from a virgin, as Isaiah testified. And some don't like that because the story in the New Testament is somewhat compelling. That Jesus' parents claim he was born of a virgin birth because that's not a story that people would like to make up. Could you imagine the difficulty that Mary and Joseph had with their own parents and their friends and their community? You're pregnant before you get married and what? Oh, that's a good story. Right. Right. It's not a story that credible people with integrity make up. And it's a story that if you make it up, you're going to suffer because of it. Because through the rest of your life, you'll be ridiculed for telling that fanciful tale to get yourself out of trouble. But your little boy grows up to be Jesus, who does miracles for all the world to see. And people who don't like the prophecy in Isaiah that says he would be born of a virgin, they say, well, that should be translated young maiden, not virgin. And that could be. The word could be translated either way. Except that the Septuagint, which was translated from Hebrew into Greek long before Christ was born, used the word virgin, unequivocal in the Greek. The prophecy was a virgin would give birth. And that's what Mary claimed to have happened. Mary did not really get a great deal of benefit out of this whole Christianity thing. She loved her son and raised him under a cloud of insult and mockery. Then when he began his ministry, the masses hated him. They wanted to kill him. She was there when he was crucified. For her to somehow conspire to make this all up, to what benefit? To what end? The predictions of what manner of life Jesus would live, and of his friends and how they would behave, and his enemies and how they would behave, and of their plots against him. The prophecies of the manner of Christ's death, the time that he would die in Daniel 9, the very year that the Messiah would be put to death. The description of his crucifixion in Psalm 22, that his hands and his feet would be pierced, yet none of his bones would be broken, say the prophecies. And we know the story that Christ's bones were not broken because he was already dead. But you know, it was the Passover lamb that Israel had celebrated for 1,500 years before Christ, the Passover, that they were not to break its bones. Why not? You killed the animal, you cook it, and you eat it. What's the difference if you break its bones? If there's any left over, you burn it. Why did God tell Moses you can't break its bones? Because it was just another one in a sea of details, of evidence to corroborate the story of Jesus Christ, that he is the Son of God who died and rose from the dead so that we can live forever. This very week, we are celebrating Resurrection Day. What are Jews all over the world celebrating? Passover, this very week. That is because Jesus Christ died as the nation was celebrating Passover. That was what all the prophecies of the Old Testament led up to. Because as the nation, each family was killing their Passover lamb, Jesus Christ was being crucified. And the story of the Passover is the lamb's blood was shed to save people from bondage and death. And the story of Jesus is his blood was shed to save us from sin and death. It's the same story, written 1,500 years apart, the first, the forerunner, so when the second happened, it would be recognized and received as true. Not only was Jesus Christ killed when the nation was killing the Passover lambs, but 4 days earlier, as Moses had put in their law, they were buying the Passover lambs, and that's when Judas sold Jesus Christ as the lamb to be slain to the high priest, to the nation. So then he was killed when the Passover lamb was killed, and then he was put in the tomb. But he called himself the bread from heaven. And you know, bread decomposes, it decays. But he was the bread from heaven. And as the prophecy said, that he would not see corruption, his body would not corrupt. And he was in the grave for 3 days and three nights, but he did not decay. Just as all the bread in all the homes throughout Israel, it was unleavened bread. So it did not decay. And the bread from heaven did not break down or decompose. Jesus was in the tomb during the Feast of Unleavened Bread. The days he was buried, the nation was celebrating the Feast of Unleavened Bread. The day he rose from the dead, that was the day after the Sabbath. The Sabbath was Saturday. The next day was Sunday. Well, what feast was the day after the Sabbath of the Unleavened Bread? That feast was called the Feast of First Fruits. In the Feast of First Fruits, you thank God for the first offering. You offer to God the first. And Jesus Christ became the first fruits to the Father, to God. He was the first of the resurrection of which we who are believers are still of the harvest. So many prophecies came true in Jesus Christ's life, death, and resurrection. And so much of the Old Testament makes no sense apart from him because he said, the Old Testament speaks of me. Jesus was crucified in Jerusalem on the top of Mount Moriah. You know, that northeastern part of the city of Jerusalem is still to this day from ancient times called Moriah. 2 Chronicles 3:1 tells us Solomon built the temple on Mount Moriah, on the same place that David had offered a sacrifice where God told him it had to be on this place, on Mount Moriah. About 1,000 years before David, Abraham went on a three-day journey and brought his son to Mount Moriah, where God told him to Mount Moriah. And he almost offered him there as a sacrifice, as God had commanded, but God told him to stop. Don't offer up your son, because 2,000 years from now, my son, Jesus Christ, will be offered up on this very spot on Mount Moriah. And you know, just as Jesus carried the wood for the cross up Golgotha, up the mountain on his back, so we read in Genesis 22, written 1,500 years before Jesus, that Abraham, he was going to offer up his son as a sacrifice and kill him because God inexplicably had told him to do that. He needed wood for the offering. In Genesis 22 says, Abraham laid the wood of the offering on the back of his son Isaac, and Isaac carried the wood for the offering up the same mountain that Jesus Christ carried the cross up 2,000 years later. And just as Jesus had his head caught in a brush of thorns, a crown of thorns, so too Abraham looked up and saw the ram caught in the thicket by his horns. And so that ram died in the place of Isaac, and Jesus died in our place, if we put our trust in him. Recorded in the history of Israel, in the Hebrew Scriptures, one of the oldest and the most popular book in the world, is a prophecy which says this, in the mount of the Lord it shall be provided. That's in Genesis 22 in Mount Moriah, where Abraham brought Isaac. You know, today, the Dome of the Rock in Jerusalem, you could go there and go on the Temple Mount and take off your shoes and go in this Muslim mosque that was established to further the religion of Muhammad. And there's a plaque there at that mosque. And that plaque, if you could read Arabic, will tell you that this mosque stands on the place where Abraham stood to offer up Isaac, his son. The religion of Islam, Christianity, and Judaism in the history of the world tells us that that spot where Abraham stood, where the temple was built, that's where Jesus Christ was crucified. And 1,500 years earlier, God gave the prophecy, in the mount of the Lord, it shall be provided. And God will provide himself the sacrifice. Jesus Christ died for us on Mount Moriah. He was buried in the tomb there that has since been excavated, and you could visit it. And he rose from the dead so that salvation can come to the world. If our Lord predicted that he would be crucified and on the third day he would rise from the grave, and this prediction came to pass, then it seems that everything else that he said must be true. Hey, this is Bob Benyar. If you would like to hear more, you could go to our store online or call us at 1-800-8-ENYART. That's 1-800-836-9278. Or go to kgov.com, click on the store, and then you can get our Bible studies, or go to the subscriptions where you could subscribe to our sermons and our Bible studies. You could get really fun verse-by-verse studies or topical Bible studies. I think you'll love it.